second case for oral argument this morning is the Enrique Pooled Advocate Trust. And for the State of South Dakota Department of Social Services, we have Ms. Becky Johnson, an Assistant Attorney General. And for the Pooled Trust, we have Mr. Thomas Simmons, an attorney from Rapid City. And I should note for the record that Ms. Beatry, who represented the individuals involved in this case, did submit a briefing and was not able to attend today because of the distance involved from Belleville, Illinois, to Pierce, South Dakota. So she will rest on her brief. With that, Ms. Jensen, you may proceed. Oh, excuse me. The court should also note the disqualification of Justice Wilbur and note the presence of the Honorable Mark Barnett, a circuit judge from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Wilbur's place. So with that, Ms. Jensen, you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Before the court today are two appeals which have been consolidated by this court and involve the Department of Social Services' ability as the single state agency assigned to administer the South Dakota Medicaid program to impose a Medicaid transfer penalty on individuals who transfer assets to a pooled trust when they are age 65 or older. The PADI appeal is an appeal by the department of a 2009 order issued by Circuit Court Judge Davis, which bars the department from imposing a Medicaid transfer penalty based on a beneficiary's age at the time they fund an account with the PADI Pooled Trust. This is the order that the department is respectfully requesting that this court vacate. It's the department's position that while Judge Davis had the authority, which he exercised in an earlier 2006 order, to determine if the PADI Trust was compliant with federal Medicaid law, he did not have the authority to order that the beneficiaries of the trust could not be subject to an imposition of a Medicaid transfer penalty.
Are there other such trusts like this in South Dakota, or is this just unique?
The PADI Pooled Trust is somewhat unique. I'm responsible for my office for reviewing trusts that come in for Medicaid purposes. The PADI Trust and the South Dakota Guardianship Program Trust are the only trusts that I'm familiar with.
Okay.
What's the advantage for a person to create this trust?
The advantage to this trust is because in 1993, the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1993, was trying to limit individuals' access to these trusts and actually trying to close some loopholes that they found were happening for purposes of people disposing of their assets and applying for Medicaid. At the same time, they recognized that people with certain disabled people, despite being on Medicaid, should have access to certain funds to supplement for the rest of their life, so to pay for things that Medicaid just simply doesn't cover. So from that legislation, they carved out three trusts to be given special treatment. The Pooled Trust is one of those.
So Pooled Trust allows certain things to be used. The disabled person can use income from that trust for certain needs, and they still won't be penalized for that. They still will be eligible for Medicaid. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. The special exemption that's given to this trust is that the assets in the trust and the income created by the account in the trust is not counted by Medicaid for eligibility purposes. So,
go ahead and finish your answer.
Both parties agree with that. What the issue here is the transfers into the trust.
As I understand it, your position is based on the federal government that's mandating your position.
That's correct.
What is their philosophy behind, if you know, allowing participation in this trust if you are disabled, but not allowing it if you're over 65? Is it an actuarial thing, or
I can't necessarily answer that. That reason doesn't appear in the legislative history, and it doesn't say specifically within the Pooled Trust statute that the person has to be age 65 or less. But one of the cases that was in my brief, Lewis versus Alexander, kind of touched upon that. They recognize that transfers to a pooled trust while over the age of 65 is subject to a penalty, and they struggled with the same concept. And their statement was, given the way it structured transfer penalties, it appears Congress concluded that for some reason disabled individuals age 65 and older, for some of these individuals, the benefits of establishing a pooled trust account would outweigh the penalties incurred by transferring assets to the trust. And I suspect, and this is just my opinion, when an individual places money in a pooled trust, the advantage to them is that they may not have a lot of money. They can pool it with other members of that trust. They can distribute the trustee fees amongst several beneficiaries. And a person over the age of 65 can still create a pooled trust in South Dakota. But they will be subject to a transfer penalty. So if they can wait out that transfer period, they can still take advantage of that trust by not counting the resources or income.
Okay. I'll let you get back to telling us what you want to tell us.
Okay.
Well, maybe not. Along the same line, when it's talking about the requirements for the pooled trust, it talks about that must be a separate trustee established for the beneficiary by the individual or family members. The last item is, to the extent that the amount of the accounts are not retained by the trust, they are transferred to the state. What is the purpose of that? What retained by the trust for what purposes? It seems to defeat the whole purpose of it.
There have been situations that the department feels that way, but it's not. That's not part of this case. They retain the certain.
I'm just trying to understand the whole philosophy to get at what does this mean.
They will retain administrative costs, certain fees or cost of administration of the trust. They're permitted to pay those from the beneficiary's account upon their death. The other thing that they are allowed to do is possibly retain those assets and distribute them amongst the remaining disabled beneficiaries. So there are situations where under this trust that the state would not be reimbursed based from that beneficiary's funds, depending upon the amounts. And it's intended, it's a payback, it's intended to say, hey, we won't count these as resource and income against your eligibility, but at the end, you should pay the state back any of the amounts that they've paid to you. So that's the purpose of the payback provisions.
Just like a lien.
Similar to a lien, although we cannot put a lien on those funds.
But you have
that individual still.
You have a priority if they're there.
Correct.
Okay.
As I've indicated, the difference between the parties here are the extent of the special treatment that these trusts are given. Both sides agree that the resources and income in these accounts is not countable for Medicaid eligibility purposes. Of course, those would cause a person to be ineligible. Both sides also agree that if the person is under the age of 65, transfers to assets to this type of trust would not be subject to the imposition of a penalty. Where the parties disagree is the treatment of the transfer of assets to a pooled trust when the beneficiary and Medicaid applicant is 65 and older. It's the department's position that under federal Medicaid law, which governs, among other things, the transfers of assets, and the corresponding South Dakota administrative rule, transfers of assets to a pooled trust by someone over the age of 65 are subject to the imposition of a penalty. This is the position that the department took in the Matthews case, and that was upheld by the administrative law judge and circuit court judge Kern. Judge Davis's 2009 order inappropriately bars the department from imposing this penalty and also conflicts with his 2006 order, which stated that transfers to the Patty Trust are not penalizing transfers, provided the beneficiary meets the requirements of this trust. The trust, in turn, requires that beneficiaries meet the requirements of the federal Medicaid statute governing pooled trusts. It's under this statute that the department asserts the imposition of a transfer penalty in the case in cases similar to Matthews is warranted.
After Judge Davis made his decision, did the federal rules or directives change, or were they the same at the time Judge Kern made her decision as when Judge Davis made his?
They have been the same. There have been varying interpretations of those rules, but the basic federal statute has not changed.
Now, when the trust was first approved, I think it was in 2006.
Correct.
The record shows, I guess, that you were aware of the age limitation thing. At least it's mentioned in your brief.
There was some. And
I can understand. I mean, looking at this Byzantine statute, how you maybe could not have contemplated every eventuality. But clearly you were aware of the 65 age limitation. Why wasn't that limitation incorporated into the requirements of approval in 2006?
First of all, the issues here, the 2006 order by Judge Davis appropriately determined whether or not the trust itself qualified under the federal statute governing these types of trusts. It's our position that the 2009 order is different in that he is now determining the eligibility of an individual Medicaid beneficiary and their eligibility for not only Medicaid but for this trust. So really two separate issues, 2006 eligibility of the trust, 2009 eligibility of a particular individual.
So in 2006, you were simply saying, okay, the trust qualifies, and people putting in assets, transferring, may or may not be subject to a penalty, depending on their age.
Correct. In 2006, at the time this trust was first approved, there were no beneficiaries of this trust. Yeah, specifically, there were no beneficiaries who were at that same time applying for Medicaid. The action itself did not address the specific age restrictions for transfers to a pooled trust. I suspect in part because at the time there were no beneficiaries.
Well, also there was this CMS memo that came out in 2008 that seems to clarify. Apparently there were some states that were not understanding the rule. You said there's been varying interpretations. It looks to me like that 2008 memo that came from Department of Health and Human Services clarified who was going to be subject to this penalty.
That's correct. That memorandum asked states to look at their transfer penalty policy in terms of this issue and ensure that they were complying with that. And they did, in their memorandums, indicated that transfers by a person over the age of 65 should be treated by the state Medicaid agency as a transfer for less than fair market value, and the state should be imposing a penalty.
You know, if the federal law is that clear, why did it take till 2008 to be talking about, and bear with me on this number, but it's, you know, 1396 PC2B4.
Yes.
Would you repeat that?
Yeah. Well, why did it take? I mean, when I look at that language, it clearly says individual under 65 years of age. How could it have been that difficult if your position is that that's the limitation to understand that?
Speaking for the department, I would say because we didn't have this situation until the Matthews case, I'm not aware of any prior situation where we've had someone at this age transfer money to the pool trust. And it has been the subject of interpretation over the past few years. The difference between the parties is that the PATI trust wants that provision only to apply to what's called third-party trusts. In other words, a trust that I've put my money into for someone else's benefit, I'm creating a third-party trust. The pooled trust at issue here is by its very nature a self-settled trust. So Patty doesn't want that provision applying to a self-settled trust, a trust where I put my own assets in for my own benefit. And that's the difference between, primary difference between the parties here today. It's the department's position that that provision doesn't distinguish between the creation of a third-party or first-party trust. And in fact, I would argue that it could apply to either type of trust. And it is the provision that upon which we are basing the imposition of the transfer penalty in the case of the Matthews.
We have two decisions to review here today. Is it your position they're irreconcilable?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
For future, we believe that Judge Davis's order, the effect of his order can be seen as quickly as the Matthews case. In the Matthews case, they argued that the department was barred in their particular case from imposing this penalty, and also argued that the department should be held in contempt of court for violating the 2009 order. Albeit they were unsuccessful, but I think the continued impact of Judge Davis's order, it will keep going in future eligibility decisions that we have to make in terms of these types of beneficiaries and their ages.
If the department obeys Judge Davis's order, if we affirm his order, does that subject the department to consequences from the federal government for potentially violating federal law?
If the federal government has told the states, hey, you have to impose a penalty under these circumstances, the department would be subject to a reduction in federal funds. I believe the other statute was 1396A. We would be subjected to a reduction in federal funds because we're not doing what the federal government is telling us to do. I'll go on unless there's any other questions at the moment.
I guess it's your turn.
Okay. specifically, that section, C2B4, states that a person will not be assessed a transfer penalty if the assets were transferred to a trust, including a trust described in subsection D4, which includes a pooled trust, established solely for the benefit of an individual under the age of 65 who is disabled. As we've discussed, the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services has interpreted this exact provision as requiring the states to impose a penalty. The Social Security's Program Operation Manual System, which also provides assistance on these issues, has also indicated that a person over the age of 65 would be subject to a penalty. In addition, while not directly deciding this issue, the courts in Lewis versus Alexander of Pennsylvania, 2011 case, the Centers for Special Needs Trust Administration versus Olson, which is a North Dakota case from April 2011, and even a case cited by Patty, the Skinzier versus Commissioner Social Services case. All those cases within their discussion about other issues granted have recognized that transfers to a pooled trust by somebody over the age of 65 are subject to a transfer penalty.
Wouldn't you have to agree, though, that language in those decisions is probably dicta?
I would agree with that, absolutely. The problem we have with this issue is that no court has directly, in my opinion, has directly decided this issue.
This may be an unfair question to ask, but isn't it amazing that every state's bound by the federal rules and there's more litigation in this? I suppose it's maddening to you, too, because you probably like some direction.
It's a little bit amazing, but as I've indicated, the cases that I've cited, those are still ongoing. They're still going to continue. I see I'm just about out of time, so I'll conclude just real quickly. The department understands that Medicaid doesn't cover every need that an individual recipient has. There is a need to allow disabled individuals who receive Medicaid to have access to funds that can be used for necessary items and services above and beyond what Medicaid provides. At the same time, this court has stated that Medicaid was designed as a safety net for those who are destitute, not free insurance coverage for those with resources available to pay. special exemption that pooled trust accounts have with regard to not counting the income or resource in such account for eligibility purposes does not extend to individuals who late in life use a pooled trust as a vehicle to dispose of assets that could be used for their care and in turn ask for their care to be paid for Medicaid. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. Okay. Mr. Simmons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Tom Simmons on behalf of Pooled Advocate Trust, Inc., which is referred to in the briefs and the record as PATI, its acronym. I'd like to first just go back to some of the questions that were raised in the state's opening argument, and then I'll try to summarize what we believe are really the core issues here. There are other pooled trusts that are located throughout the country. None are situs in the state of South Dakota. Many of them are restricted to residents of their own state, as this particular trust is only available to South Dakota residents. There may be one in Missouri, for example, that's only for Missouri residents. Some of those are regional or nationwide and accept beneficiaries from any state. There's a directory that's listed in footnote 18 of page 36 of our brief, which contains a listing of all the pooled trusts throughout the country, just for reference. The federal mandate that's referred to coming out of 2008 is, to my understanding, a letter directive from the CMS office in Boston that says transfers to a pooled trust may be a transfer because a beneficiary usually receives nothing comparable in return. It does not appear to be an absolute directive, and it's not from the CMS office in Denver, which is, to my understanding, the regional office which South Dakota specifically falls under. It's also noteworthy, I think, that there are states which have taken the express view that transfers to a pooled trust by individuals 65 and older cannot be penalized consistent with federal law.
You mean state agencies have taken that view, or there's still cases where courts have upheld that?
State agencies have taken that position, Your Honor. I don't believe there's any express cases on point. There is now, for example, an administrative rule in the state of Illinois, 120.347D2, which expressly states that. That is flying in the face of a CMS directive for Chicago region, that covers the state of Illinois. So they're flatly contradicting a CMS directive in their state. And we don't have a directive that mandates our state in any case, and not all the states are going along with that. If we reach an actual Medicaid analysis, and we're looking at 42 U.S.C. 1396P, it's Byzantine. If the drafter were here in the courtroom, you wouldn't be getting any pats on the back. But if you read it carefully, it's readable. And if you read it carefully, as Maryland, for example, has done, and Wisconsin has done, and Illinois has done, you'll see that the parenthetical statement that's referred to by the state as the crux of their argument that transfers are not allowed is misplaced. It's out of context. The retention requirement.
Well, now tell me about that.
Yes, Justice.
I mean, I'm looking at it. What's out of context?
What 1396P does is, in context, it first starts to talk about when a divestment can be penalized, a divestment being a gift to another person, and when there are exceptions to that rule. It talks about, for example, that you can transfer your home to a child if the child is under 21. You can transfer home to a sibling if the sibling has an equity interest. And you can make transfers in trust for disabled individuals under certain circumstances. Number one, if I'm the Medicaid applicant, I can make a transfer to a trust for my disabled child, regardless of their age. I can also make a transfer in a trust without it being penalized as a divestment by me as the transferor to a disabled trust for regardless to anyone as long as they are under age 65. So a child regardless of age, and to any individual if they're under 65. For example, my niece is disabled. I could make a transfer to her, but only so long as she is under 65. What the parenthetical statement then is referring to is, even if my niece is a PADI beneficiary, I can't make a transfer to her PADI trust, to a D4C trust, unless she's under the age of 65. That makes sense in context. It's talking about a third-party transfer, and it's closing a loophole that would otherwise be available to people to divest themselves of assets to other parties who are disabled.
Okay, what part of the statute limits 2B4 to third-party transfers? Is that's what you're saying, right?
Yes.
What language... What subsection do you get that from?
It doesn't expressly say that, Justice, and that's why it takes a careful read to say where that comes in context. To give full effect to all those statutory provisions, though, including the ones that follow that talk about self-settled trust transfers and when those are a problem and when they're not, that's the only analysis of the statute that really gives effect to all of the provisions, is to treat Section B as covering third-party transfers, and Section D, including transfers to trust that benefit oneself. I don't think we're able to reach that point, though. I don't think we actually get to look at federal Medicaid law, because the order that's being appealed from simply made a ruling that this had been previously adjudicated. And Judge Davis didn't pull out the Medicaid code, because all he had to look at was his prior ruling. And we believe that the standard for review in reviewing Judge Davis's decision about his own prior ruling in a petition for further relief is governed by the abuse of discretion standard, because he's interpreting his own order. He's determining whether this was something that his prior order was intended to encompass. And if you look at our original complaint that brought the request for declaratory relief, it's clearly intended to identify all the issues, including counting the trust as a resource and when transfers to the trust are divestments.
But when we read a legal order, we don't have the discretion to read it incorrectly. I mean, why would the circuit judge have the right to do that? If you're reading an order, it's a legal question, what that order means. And we've always said that's de novo.
I don't know that there's actual decisions from this court, Justice Konenkamp, with regard to the standard of review on the review of a petition for further relief being granted or denied. What the Lakeside case says, and it's the only case that we've identified as speaking to this, is that because a request for further relief is discretionary inherently, the court may or may not grant further relief, that itself is a discretionary order that's reviewed on abuse of discretion. What we asked for here in our initial request was simply for the court to clarify the order. We could have asked for an injunction by way of example as well. We haven't at this point.
You have questioned the state's position on the grounds that this Massachusetts memorandum doesn't affect South Dakota. At what level or time would there be a decision by a federal agency or court that would be binding on DSS? What are they missing, in other words?
I don't know that a letter from CMS is a legal ruling that they're bound to follow. I don't believe they cited any authority to that effect. Clearly, if the federal government would amend its statute to clarify, I think that would be something that would affect future transfers. But ultimately, Medicaid is a federal set of rules that states must follow. They can't just pick and choose which Medicaid rules they follow when they agree to participate in the program. It's the no more restrictive rule. And the Lewis v. Alexander case that the state cited speaks to that very clearly, in that the state may not make up rules that deviate from the federal requirements for the program.
So if the federal, it seems to me that if DSS is required to apply federal law as they interpret it, that they're in an impossible situation, because either they're going to violate federal law by honoring Judge Davis's order, or they're going to have to not honor Judge Davis's order in order to comply with federal law. How do we reconcile that?
Justice Conan Kemp, I believe the answer to that question is if you look at the federal Medicaid rules do not penalize transfers to a 60 to a pooled trust. That's not what federal law says.
But I mean, okay, that's your interpretation, but if we disagree with you, are we not put in this dilemma of having an impossible order? How do they comply with that if you're wrong and your interpretation is wrong?
I don't believe, Justice Conan Kemp, that I'm aware of any authority that would allow CMS to make that kind of directive absent clear ruling from the federal government.
The only rulings we have from the federal government are the CMS memo, which you say is from Boston and doesn't apply, and a Social Security Administration statement. Everything else is state courts interpreting it, or state agencies interpreting it. So, I mean, the best available that we have is this stuff from the federal, these interpretations from the Department of Health and Human Services. I guess that wasn't a question. I wanted a response from it.
Justice Conan Kemp, I believe that the Boston CMS directive is not binding here. Second of all, I'm not sure of what level of deference it itself is entitled to. I have not seen any specific law that says this becomes a federal statute by virtue of coming out of an office of CMS in the form of a letter.
Do you see the rulings of Judge Kern and Judge Davis as irreconcilable?
Ultimately, yes. The troubling part of the procedural history of this is that it gets to the exhaustion issue. And in my view, the case is quite simply a review of whether Judge Davis was correct in interpreting his own order. And that gets affirmed unless there's an exhaustion issue. The Matthews case itself now has been fully exhausted. It's before this court. I don't believe there's any further exhaustion issues with that. It shouldn't have originally been an issue in terms of the department deviating from the stipulation it had previously entered into with regards to this particular pooled trust. If they had simply followed the stipulation that they originally voluntarily entered into, they would have not then been in a position of deviating from a stipulation that they'd entered into. When Judge Davis specifically came back and clarified his ruling, he was not making an eligibility decision for the Matthews. They could have been ineligible for any host of reasons. In fact, I haven't followed that case closely, but I believe there were other issues in terms of their eligibility that did not relate to this trust. Those issues were not addressed by Judge Davis, and he didn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Those are all specifically vested in the ALJ and should continue to. This very narrow issue as a matter of law with regards to this particular trust is a matter of law now that binds the department as to this particular issue for this particular trust. The reason that the exhaustion requirements for this particular trust weren't originally required is because the trust had no beneficiaries. And the exhausting exceptions articulated by this court recognize that when the agency doesn't have original jurisdiction over a matter, there's no exhaustion requirement. We could have not have taken this pooled trust, which is a master trust document. It's very unique for most trusts that have a specific beneficiary identified. This is one trust document for any number of people. And people join it with a joinder agreement and then follow the provisions in the single master trust document. We sought a declaration from the court just to work out any eligibility issues associated with that before individuals came to
it. That's good proactive lawyering. That's setting up a trust and making sure that it complies with the law before you invite people to join it.
That's what we were trying to achieve. And the question was asked, why are there no other decisions on these pooled trusts? Quite frankly, I think the reason is quite practical. Most of the people that fund this kind of a trust are people that are already on Medicaid. They're frankly not frequently elderly people. They're frequently people in the midst of their lives. They're significantly disabled. They get an inheritance out of the blue or get a lawsuit settlement out of the blue. And they want to just maintain the status quo, and Congress has allowed them to do that by funding a trust that follows the federal requirements. Most of those people don't have much money, and they can't afford to bring cases to challenge the Medicaid rules that are adopted by the states. The first few people to join this trust funded with amounts of, I think, $4,000, $8,000. I mean, they're people with almost nothing, but just enough to put them over the Medicaid limits, and the law allows them to fund a trust for this with these requirements and stay in compliance. Originally, when OBRA 93 was adopted and Congress articulated these rules, there were already nonprofit agencies which were doing this. And there was no specific federal mandate that allowed them to. But you'd have disabled agencies like Black Hills Workshop, for example, where I come from, that set up simple master pooled trusts for their people where they could fund these amounts and still supplement things that they might need that the government wouldn't pay for. A second haircut a week. Getting your hair washed more than a nursing home might wash it ordinarily, car repairs, a nicer set of shoes, car repairs, things that the government is not going to pay for, supplemental needs beyond what Medicaid will pay for. And the nonprofit element to it was in recognition of the trusts that were already established. The retention requirement that was alluded to spoke to the fact that usually in those situations, Black Hills Workshop, with this pooled trust, had a beneficiary pass away. If they had enough to repay the state from that subaccount for the Medicaid lien, they would do so. And that's what the federal statute still directs the trust to do. And this trust is specifically drafted to direct the trustee, whenever you can repay the Medicaid lien from the subaccount, you do so first. If there's not enough to pay the lien back, then those funds are reallocated among the other trust beneficiaries. Now, what nonprofits were typically doing is just...
You lost me. If they can pay the state back, they do it. If they can't, then they take the money and put it elsewhere. How does that work? And that goes to the same section I was asking about previously, section whatever it is for... to the extent that it is not retained by the trust, then it pays back the state.
I struggled with that same language when we were drafting this trust, is what does that mean? What it meant for a Black Hills Workshop is they'd use those funds. They'd make an improvement in one of their group homes or repave their parking lot or whatever. They'd use those. They would personally retain those funds. This nonprofit, PADI, all it does is this trust. It doesn't have disabled individuals that it can help. So the way we'd initially drafted the trust was when there was an amount in a subaccount that was insufficient to discharge the Medicaid lien and had to be retained in conformity with that statute, that we distributed to the South Dakota Community Foundation, and the South Dakota Community Foundation distributed among disabled advocacy groups and service groups throughout the state. The state resisted that and said, no, that's not retaining. And Judge Davis agreed, this is back in 2006, and said, if you're going to retain, what retain means is among the other beneficiaries of the trust. So that was actually a point that the state won on. We had argued that we should distribute it to nonprofit disability groups. The state said no, and we ended up revising the trust, reforming the trust, consistent with their prevailing on that argument, so that funds that are not repaid to the Medicaid lien are held by other beneficiaries of the trust for their benefits. To the extent funds are not retained in the trust, DSS gets repaid, is what that says.
But isn't that switching the way the statute is written?
I might not be quoting it exactly. But what it says is if you're going to distribute to any individuals, say the beneficiary dies and the beneficiary has a son, if you're going to distribute anything to that son, you first have to repay the state. Nothing can go to any individual unless the state is made whole. Otherwise, the trust has to retain those amounts.
So basically, DSS never gets repaid.
No, that's not true. They would get repaid, and our trust specifically directs the trustee, shall, whenever you have a subaccount which is greater than what DSS is owed, you repay the state every time. There's no discretion there by the trustee. So the beneficiaries of the pooled trust, there's about 21 of them now, are not in the courtroom today. If they were, we'd see that they share some common traits as South Dakotans with disabilities. But we'd also see that they're individuals facing enormous challenges. Their lives are not lives that any of us would envy. Pooled trusts in other states like Texas or New York might have thousands of beneficiaries, full-time paid staff, offices. We don't. Our budget is almost non-existent. We get $100 per applicant, and if you multiply 100 times 21, you'll see our gross revenue since inception. Those beneficiaries on SSI or Medicaid will typically have a net worth of $2,000 or less. The amount in the pooled trust for them is the sole means of support beyond what the government will pay for. We ask that Judge Davis's decision be affirmed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Ms. Jansen, you have 10 minutes.
I have a couple of things I want to clear up, and with respect to the discussion about the CMS memorandums. There were actually two memorandums. One was issued in April 2008, one was issued in May of 2008. One was from the Boston Regional Office, the other was from the Baltimore Regional Office. Those were admitted as Exhibits 17 and 18 in the Matthews Appeal. Both letters read almost identically in terms of how CMS has interpreted the provision imposing the transfer penalty for somebody transferring assets beyond age 65. Granted, CMS's interpretation doesn't equate to a court analyzing the statute and making a determination, but I believe that letters from CMS are given deference. I don't have the case citation. It is in one of my briefs that I submitted to the court. Even when not formalized by adoption of an administrative regulation, CMS interpretation of the federal statutes governing the Medicaid program is entitled to some respect.
What is your answer, though, to the statement that the Denver office, the CMS office for Denver, has not issued a letter like this, and therefore it's not binding?
To my knowledge, I have not received the letter or seen the letter specifically related to the state of South Dakota. I would assume that CMS is all a part of one federal agency. I have to assume that that oversees all the states in governing the Medicaid program. I would have to assume that each region would be consistently applied this interpretation across the board.
Has any region gone against the memos from Baltimore and Boston?
I know, as Mr. Simmons had pointed out, there are some states that have declined to impose a penalty in this situation by rule. To my knowledge, those have not been challenged, but there has not been any case law that has said the state cannot do that.
But at the federal level, have there been any regions? You said Denver's been silent, but are only Baltimore and Boston the only two regions that have addressed it, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, those are the only two memorandums from CMS that I have seen. The other matter that I want to address, Mr. Simmons indicates that Judge Davis didn't get into federal Medicaid law when he issued the 2009 order. It's a difficult argument to make because throughout the pleadings filed by Patty in both the initial petition and the petition for further relief, all of their pleadings ask Judge Davis to find this trust compliant with federal Medicaid laws. So there would have to be, one would assume, some analysis of Medicaid law by Judge Davis. However, he did not issue any findings or conclusions with respect to at least the 2009 order, so it's difficult to determine exactly what went into his analysis before he issued that order. Um, And lastly, one of the last points that I'd like to make, Mr. Simmons indicates that the department deviated from the 2006 order that it stipulated to. Again, the difference here is the 2006 order applying to the judge finding the Patty Trust compliant with federal Medicaid law. The 2009 order dealt with specific individual beneficiaries' eligibility, which we see as two very separate issues. We do believe that the 2009 order is not reconcilable with the Matthews decision, and I think that if it's upheld, the 2009 order is upheld, I would anticipate further litigation with respect to the individual beneficiaries, maybe the department being found in, or held in contempt or an argument in contempt. So they are reconcilable. There has to be a give somewhere. And lastly, I did want to point out, with respect to the Matthews, Mr. Simmons indicated that the only issue involved in their case, or there were several issues involved in their case, not just issues involving this trust. With respect to Gladys Matthews, that was the only thing keeping her from having her care paid for, is the fact that she transferred these assets. So the only issue involving Gladys Matthews was the fact that she transferred assets. And I want to specifically note, with respect to Fred Matthews, the circuit court specifically found that he waived any issue related to the transfer penalty imposed on him because he did not appeal it. And if there are not any other questions, I would just respectfully request that this court vacate Judge Davis' 2009 order and upheld Circuit Court Judge Kern's decision in the Matthews appeal.
Let me ask you about now Fred Matthews. Judge Kern found that he waived it, but wouldn't Judge Davis' 2009 order cover him? I mean, that's his.
I suspect that it possibly could, if that argument was made. She did not. The administrative law judge denied Ms. Vetri's request to incorporate the entire Patty file into the proceedings at the administrative law judge level. So there was no decision based on that. And Judge Kern certainly didn't have that before her. So there's possibility that he could be covered under that provision. I don't know what impact at this point that would have on him. Both the Matthews are deceased.
Okay.
I have one other thing. How do you respond to Mr. Simmons' point that if you read the entire 1396 in context, you can come to his interpretation?
I think that the department has read it in context. I would think that C2B4, if there was an intention by Congress to only apply that to, for example, a third-party trust or maybe a first-party trust, that they could have made that distinction within that statute. It's our position that that provision could apply to either a third-party or self-settled trust. And secondly, the reason I think we've read it in context is a D4 trust, by its very nature, for Medicaid purposes, is a self-settled trust. So, for example, if I transfer money to someone else for someone else's benefit into a pooled trust, and that someone else applies for Medicaid, the assets in that trust and the income in that trust is going to be subject to the normal trust counting rules because it's not their assets in the trust, the very first requirement. It's mine. So by their very nature, a D4 trust for purposes of Medicaid is a self-settled trust.
And that definition is found in D4 itself, right?
The requirement that it contain the assets of the disabled individual.
That's not in C, that's in D.
That's in D4C.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jansen. Court will be in recess.